He is electrical engineer by training, and already very early in his career, he was interested in how to implement neural processing principles in hardware. And ever since then, he's working on neuromorphic engineering, and he did so in his PhD in Caltech. And immediately after his PhD, he already got a position as a PI at University of Pennsylvania. And since 2006, he has moved his lab to Stanford University. And I'm glad that he's here today, and we'll talk about big numbers, million neurons, billion synapses, and I think 16 chips. Please.
All right. Thank you very much for the introduction and for the invitation. This is really a great meeting. It's really a great turnout, and it's a great lineup of speakers. And it's really an honor to be here to join you and talk about, you know, a little bit different from what you've heard in the earlier talks. Is this thing working? Can you guys hear me? Okay. Yeah, a little bit different from what you heard about in the earlier talks. This is more about trying to think about ways in which we can really scale up the kinds of models that we are building to much larger scale and the kind of problems that you run into when you try to do this on conventional hardware. And it turns out that a group of people called neuromorphic engineers have been working on building computers that work like the brain. And it turns out that these are also going to be much better at doing these large-scale simulations. And so NeuroGrid is a system, basically the state-of-the-art neuromorphic system here, which can simulate a million neurons connected by billions of synapses in real time. And this is what it looks like. It's a little PCB. I have one of them here. It's smaller than your iPod. This thing has 16 chips that were designed in my lab. We call them NeuroCores. And together, those 16 chips networked together on this board, you know, consume about 5 watts and are able to simulate, just using that little amount of power, a million neurons connected by billions of synapses. And the talk is going to describe basically the idea or the principles behind this approach, a little bit of the history, and then talk about, you know, what it looks like from a computational sciences point of view. If you're going to use one of these systems, what kinds of systems can you implement? What kind of user interface do we have for this, and so forth? And then at the end, talk a little bit about, we are also interested in doing some computational neuroscience ourselves. And so we're going to talk about, you know, early modeling efforts that we've started using NeuroGrid. And so, you know, in this audience, I'm sure everybody runs these simulations and spends a lot of time, you know, going to get coffee while they are waiting for their simulations to run. So it's not surprising. But, you know, just to tell you sort of what the state of the art is in these large-scale simulations, this is the, my battery is weak on this. Do you have a pointer? Yeah, so this is a... These two cores here are what's used in the BlueGene L supercomputer. It's got 2 PowerPC cores on there. They are clocked at 700 megahertz. And so that chip gives you about 1.4 gigaflops per second. And 2 of them sit on a card, which will get you up to about 3 gigaflops. That's like similar to your desktop computer. And but unlike your desktop computer, this is using about 15 watts. So it's an order of magnitude more efficient. And so IBM is very proud of this, okay? And in terms of, you know, the amount of, you know, what size network you can simulate in real time, that, you know, little card there can do something like about 30 Hodgkin-Huxley-style neurons in real time. And to do a Worm's 302-neuron brain, you need one of these little blades, which has 16 of those cards in it with, you know, 64 cores. And if you go up to buy a full rack, which has 32 of these blades in it and 2,000 cores, that can get you up to something like an ANT's 10,000-neuron brain in real time. You're actually limited more by the connectivity, the amount of synaptic connections you have. And, you know, this is looking at, you know, thousands of connections per you know, neuron. And, you know, that those 2,000 cores rack give you about 3 teraflops of performance. And it costs $2 million for one rack like that from IBM. IBM will also sell you, if you have more money, will sell you the full supercomputer. It has 64 racks, about 130,000 cores, and that's good for doing about 1 million neurons in real time. Okay, this is like the size of a bee's brain. In comparison with NeuroGrid, we've been able to achieve that kind of 1 million neuron type performance with this little card that I showed you, and you know, using just about 5 watts of power. Okay. And so this little guy here is comparable to 22 BlueJeans racks. And the numbers work out as follows. You know, I don't make this stuff up, okay? People actually have run cortical simulations on BlueJeans. These specific numbers come from a simulation that was run by IBM themselves, their researchers. They had 55 million neurons connected by about 460 billion synapses, spiking at about 7.2 hertz. And on 16 racks, it took 325 seconds to simulate 5 seconds of that network's behavior, okay? And so if you actually calculate, you know, in that time, you know how fast these racks are, how much computation they do, you can calculate how many floating point operations they did each time a synapse fired in the model. And that comes out to be, actually, it's about 909 floating point operations each time a synapse is activated. And I'm rounding it down to 1K. And so if we compare that with what NeuroGrid can do, we've got 65,000 neurons on each neural core, and we've got 1 million on the board. Each of these guys can be connected to 6,000 others. And when they are spiking at about 10 hertz, that's about 63 billion synapses being activated each second. If you multiply that by 1,000 floating point operations for each synaptic activation, you get 63 teraflops. And at 3 teraflops for a BlueJeans rack, that's how you get 22 racks to do the kind of computation that NeuroGrid is doing. Okay? And so the rest of the talk, I'm going to tell you basically how we're able to do this and how we're able to do this in a way that's programmable, because one of the problems with the approach that us and others have been using is, like, instead of doing things digitally, we do things in analog. And one of the drawbacks of analog is that it's not programmable. But we've come up with a way of making it programmable so that you can actually implement various different types of cells, different types of networks, and so forth, so on and so forth, on NeuroGrid. And then the other thing I have to talk about is also how we make the connectivity programmable, because also traditionally, a lot of these neuromorphic chips were hardwired, and so you couldn't actually change the way these neurons were connected. But now we can do that. And so that's the main thing we're going to talk about in the talk. So let's first talk about the approach, which is to use analog instead of digital to do the computation, okay? And, you know, I like to think about this, actually, it's very similar to how the brain works. If you look at the dendrites of these neurons, they are getting all these spikes coming in. The synapses are triggering these postsynaptic potentials, which are millivolt or less. And thousands of these things summate together, not necessarily in a linear fashion, and eventually exceed a threshold at the soma, and then you trigger a spike. So everything that happens in the dendrite is analog in the sense that it's graded levels of things that are combining. And then the spike is digital. It's all or nothing. And so the communication between neurons is digital, and the computation, because I like to think that what the dendrites do is computation, is analog. And so we actually use a very similar approach, right? All the computation in NeuroGrid is done in an analog fashion, and then the communication is digital, okay? Now, it makes a lot of sense because actually analog is very efficient at computation, okay? So in this particular case, what we are trying to do is we are trying to model the current that's flowing through a population of ion channels, you see here. And in an analog approach, what you would do is you would use a transistor and you'd have current flowing through the channel of the transistor that matches the current that's flowing through this population of ion channels, okay? And you set up the way in which this voltage is generated in the circuit such that when the membrane voltage changes across that neuron and those currents change across those ion channels, then this current will also change in the same way, okay? So that's why it's called an analog computation. It's just an analogous thing. It turns out that this is actually very natural to do with transistors when they're operating in the regime where they pass similar amount of currents as these ion channels do. So, you know, if you've got about 10,000 ion channels open, you're passing about 10 nanoamps. And the currents are going to range from like, you know, nanoamps to picoamps. And when you operate transistors in those regime, that's called the subthreshold regime, where the transistor is thought to be off, but actually it's not off. As the voltage changes, you get an exponential increase in current in the subthreshold regime. And this is directly analogous to the way in which, you know, the ion currents are controlled, actually. So if you look in the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, you see a whole bunch of exponentials. And those are coming from the physics of the ion channels, and we get the same kind of exponential relationship. So it makes it very natural to model things like Hodgkin-Huxley with analog circuits, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But now I just wanted to highlight, you know, the kinds of, you know, challenges that we faced in trying to build NeuroGrid, okay? So back when I did my PhD, I worked on modeling the silicon retina, and I actually really enjoyed Heimstetter's, excuse the pronunciations, talk yesterday, where they reconstructed this whole chunk of retina. It's just beautiful to watch, and you could see, you know, all these different cells tiling and the different layers and so forth and so on. But even back 20 years ago, we still had a pretty good idea what the circuitry in the retina was. So you could talk to your retinal physiologist and anatomist, and they could tell you, you know, horizontal cells are inhibiting, you know, bipolars and cones, and, you know, you've got this connection at the amacrine cell layer with these dyad or triad synapses and so forth. And so based on those descriptions, you know, we came up with a model here that really reproduces the output of all four types of ganglion cells in the mammalian retina. These would be like your powerful and Magnus stream, transient with larger receptive fields, sustained with smaller receptive fields. And this was a culmination of an effort that was started by Carver-Mead in the mid-80s when he launched this whole analog VLSI approach. And what you're seeing, looking up here, is, you know, the response of these about 60 by 40 ganglion cell array. You can see the yellow and the blue lighting up when there's motion. Those are the transient responding ganglion cells, and they are more sparse at about half the resolution. And then you can see the red and the green, you know, basically more sustained responding, but enhancing edges here as Kareem moves in that background. And this is a reconstruction of the image from this sparse representation that the retina puts out. One of the things that was very interesting here is that there's a lot of heterogeneity when you use these transistors in the subthreshold regime, and traditional analog designers basically are very scared of designing in that regime. And it turned out that once you actually use the same kind of circuitry and the same kind of connections, the gap junctions and all that in the retina, you were able to get a really robust response despite the heterogeneity in the system. And we just heard from Alex Bouget's talk that heterogeneity is also good in terms of your coding capacity, right? It makes you robust to correlations and so forth. And so this is actually something very interesting. A lot of people who build these models don't include any heterogeneity in there and don't try to address, you know, these kinds of issues. And in the analog approach, you actually have to deal with this directly. It just comes from the physics of the devices. And so how do we go from a silicon retina like that, which is sort of hardwired, each of those, you know, voltages or silicon neurons that we've implemented on the chip are modeling a specific type of neuron, to something like this, where you can use the same chip to model different types of neurons, okay? So in this case here, this is actually, in this panel here, the top is a NeuroGrid chip that has been configured to model regular spiking, fast spiking, chattering, or intrinsic bursting, those 1, 2, 3, 4. And the middle is the actual in vitro recordings from McCormick lab, and also some of these from Isakiewicz's website. And so what you can see here is that we can do a pretty good job matching what the physiology is doing. And we did this all without fabricating four different chips to model these four different types of cells. And the reason we're able to do that, this goes back to work that Kai Hanna did in the lab about 5-6 years ago, where he came up with an analog circuit that can basically solve the Hodgkin-Huxley equations. Okay, so what you see here is recordings from in vitro recordings where they are recording the current flowing through T-type calcium channels, and, you know, in response to different steps of membrane voltage. And I'm just checking my time here. And in the bottom is the same kind of experiment performed with the analog circuit here. And in particular, you can see we are capturing the nonlinear behavior, which Hodgkin and Huxley summarized by sigmoidal dependence of the steady state on the membrane voltage and a bell-shaped time constant, right? So if we also do the same thing here, this is what the physiological data looks like, and that's what we can get out of the circuit. That's the steady state dependence. And furthermore, we can shift these curves around, right? So we can model like a low threshold activation or a higher threshold of activation. We can also model inactivation, okay, just based on the bias voltages that we apply to these terminals in the circuit. And so that allows us to model other types of ion channels, not just the T-type, you know, low threshold potassium, and so on and so forth. And in terms of the temporal behavior, you know, you get sort of this bell-shaped time constant dependence, and we can also model that as well, and we can speed it up or slow it down, and we can shift it around, right? And so with this same circuit, we can model different types of ion channels, and by modeling different types of ion channels, we can model different kinds of cells, right? Because this is why the cells are different. And so that approach, modeling at the Hodgkin-Huxley level, allowed us to be able to then program different cell behaviors, if you like, into the same chip, okay? So that's the first thing that makes NeuroGrid programmable. And then just a word about how we do the synapses, because synapses are a big part of the hardware or about of the computation that you have to do, because each neuron can have thousands of synapses. You want to implement your synapses very efficiently, okay? And so the way that we did that, this is just showing you the kind of synaptic model we implemented. This is actually based on a model proposed by Alain Destex and Sejnowski, where it's really, there's a rise time for the synapse, which is programmable. So this would be the conductance waveforms, right? A spike comes in, it triggers one of these, you know, changes in conductances. And so this is changing the rise time. This is changing the saturation value, which rescales the whole curve. And then you can change the decay constant. You can see things are decaying fast or slow. And you can change the reversal potential. So all these things are programmable, right? But what we do is we actually make all the synapses of the same type have the same parameters, right? And so by so doing, we can basically program the same one value for each that's shared by all those synapses. They have the same rise time, saturation value, time constant, and reversal potential. And then if we make the assumption that these synaptic potentials summate linearly, to produce the total conductance across that cell's membrane, we can actually use a single analog circuit to model that entire population of synapses. Okay, so the way it works is like this. These will be your analog circuitry. You send your spikes in, and you trigger these waveforms. And then these conductances will sum, and postsynaptically, you'll get this net change in conductance, okay? And what you can do is instead of sending all these spikes to different circuits, you can send them to the same circuit. And by designing this circuit to give you linear superposition, you can get the output of the circuit can be just give you the total conductance, okay? And so that actually allows us with the same single circuit to model, you know, all the ampere synapses that a neuron receives just with that same circuit. We just send all those spikes to that same circuit. And then we can use another circuit to model all the NMDA synapses, and so on and so forth, right? And so this is actually allows us to basically implement in, you know, about this much of silicon. So that's about 40, you can see, yeah, that's about 40 by 50 microns of silicon. If you haven't seen a chip design before, it's just a little painting program, and you paint all these different colors, okay? And the the red is the gate of the transistor, the green is the channel, and yellow where they overlap is the actual channel. That's where you can turn on the current and turn it off. Okay, it's like the pore of the ion channel can open or it can close. That's the analogous thing in the transistor, okay? And so, you know, there's about 300 of those transistors here, and we've highlighted different parts of the neuron, okay? In particular, it's a two-compartment model, so we've got the soma, and the soma has built into it the spike-generating channels. Okay, we are not using Hodgkin-Huxley for that. We just use a simple quadratic integrated fire neuron model. And so that's very compact. And it's okay if you don't really care about the exact waveform of the spike. That's just fine. Now, then we have a dendritic compartment. And this is coupled to the stoma, and the spikes can backpropagate into the dendrite, so you can model that as well. And then these synapses I told you with the programmable rise time, fall time, maximum conductance, and reversal potential, we can have to have four different synaptic populations here modeled by those four blocks. And then we have channels, so we can have up to four different gating variables that we can model. And then those guys, we can populate the dendrite with those guys to generate things like bursting or like nonlinear, you know, amplification of EPSPs as they propagate. And also, we can actually use this to implement the voltage dependence. You can couple a channel with a synapse, and that's how we implement NMDA, because the sigmoidal steady state gives us the voltage dependence of the NMDA. So we can do NMDA as well. And so that's basically what one of these neurons looks like. When you tile an array of 256 by 256 of these neurons across the chip, you end up with that much real estate. Okay, that's actually a very big chip. It's about 12 millimeters by 14 millimeters. And it's got a total of about 23 million transistors. And it's 160 square millimeters in 0.18 micron technology, which is about a, you know, 12 years old technology. Okay, so you could make this much smaller in state-of-the-art technology. And so that's basically all the analog stuff that's going on now. How do you connect these neurons together? How do you get one of them to connect to 6,000 others, right? How do you route these connections in a programmable way? And so this is the participation here. Before I get into that, this is just a little video that demonstrates actual recording. And this is what, you know, you can interface on the user interface. You can interact with this. Yeah, so I'll explain briefly. What this represents is basically all the activity that's going on in a particular chip that we've basically selected. And each time a spike happens in a neuron, you get this little white, you know, thing light up, okay? They call it a sparkle plot. It sparkles. And we have something called a probe, which is shown here. And we are probing this particular neuron at this location. And that allows us to look at analog signals that are inside that neuron. Basically, we can see all the spikes from all the neurons, but this is like our intracellular electrode that we're getting actually things like the dendritic. We can look at the dendritic voltage. We have four of these signals coming out. The dendritic voltage, which is low, the soma voltage, which is low. There's a particular channel that we are probing, so it's got an inactivation variable that's high, and it's got an activation variable that's low. And we do a simple Kirin injection into that cell, actually into all the neurons. So you see that whole plane light up. And then we look at what happens in this particular neuron. You see the inactivation go down, the activation come on. You can see the dendrite depolarizing. You see the things start to spike. So that just summarizes the kind of activity that you can model with one of these neurons here. So just watch for it, it will depolarize, you see all the activity. Yeah, there you go. And you can see those spikes being generated, you can see the activity. And then that's the end of the current stimulus. And so that's just to give you a little bit of a feel for what these things look like. They look very much like the kind of stuff that you see on your computer, you know, where you run your stuff. And so the way that we connect the neurons together is by using an approach here where, you know, this is just giving you an example here, but this is something also goes back to work of Misha Mahowald in Kavamid's lab, developing a way in which we can actually read out lots and lots of spikes out of a chip, okay? The problem you have there is that you don't have a lot of wires coming off of the chip because of limitations in the way the packaging technology that, you know, we use for electronics, but you have much faster wires, right? And so you can actually multiplex, or you can basically send all these spikes over a smaller set of wires, but you'd have to actually explicitly label each one. And once you do that, then you can do all kinds of cool stuff, right? Because you have a bunch of addresses coming off of here, and you can basically route those things to a computer over USB. You can watch all the spikes going on. That's how I showed you in the previous slide what was going on. We were just recording from NeuroGrid over USB. And you can also then take these addresses and program some connectivity into a RAM, and basically route the spike from this neuron back to any other neuron on that chip, right? Now, NeuroGrid sort of takes this further, right, to a multi-chip system, not just going back into that chip, but going from one chip to another. So in this case, you know, what you have on this chip, each of these neurons has an address, and each of those targets has an address. And by going through a lookup table, you can implement this sort of connectivity pattern that you see here. So when you see address 3, you look up location 3, you pull out 0, you send that to that chip. That triggers the synapse, and this neuron gets a little EPSP, you know, in it, right? And so, you know, in a single chip approach, what you would do is you would basically take, you know, all your neurons on the chip, and you basically program each of them to model different types of cells. And then you would route those addresses through this memory here, and then you implement whatever connectivity you wanted among that group to try and sort of mimic this kind of cortical structure, okay? But since we wanted to optimize NeuroGrid to model cortex, and we wanted to be able to scale to a million neurons, we took a close look at cortex, and we realized that, well, you've got this kind of structure, right? The connectivity is not random. You can notice that this is a column here, which means this green neuron talks to that blue neuron just the same way this green neuron talks to that blue neuron. That comes back and that comes back. So this columnar microsecond is replicated across the cortex. And so instead of storing all those connections individually, you could store just one set of connection once, right? And then you could just replicate that, okay? And what that means is that you only have to store the connectivity between the chips. Basically, if we use this chip here to model all the green neurons, and we use this chip to model all the brown ones, then we just say green chip talks to blue chip, and then blue chip talks to brown chip. And that's just a very small set of connections we have to store. And so that's actually what we do on NeuroGrid. But in addition, then, these long-range connections, which go from some arbitrary column to some arbitrary column, is all that we have to store in the lookup table off-chip, which is the bottleneck. And then we also want to implement this ABO function, because you also notice that anatomically, these axons go along, and when they make a connection, they actually arborize densely over some couple of hundred microns, right, within sort of a column. And so so the NeuroGrid then looks more like this, where you've got basically, you know, one chip per cell type, okay? And then you basically then have, you know, up to 16 cell types, because you've got 16 chips in NeuroGrid. And then you've also then got one set of parameters per chip, because all those cells are of the same type. You only have to store one set of parameters. That saves you a lot of area. And then you also then have to route these vertical connections, we call them, the intracolumnar connections. And you can actually store those, because there's only a small set of connections, you can store them on chip. And that also then means you can be translating all these things in parallel. And then for your horizontal connections, you use your off-chip RAM to store that. And then finally, once you deliver a spike into the array, you can program some diameter for its arbor to model this, you know, local arbor, right? And that's basically done in an analog fashion. Basically, you implement a cable model and you allow those things to decay with some space constant that's programmable. And so with this approach, we can take one spike here, translate it into something like 10 horizontal connections. Then those horizontal connections can hit up to 6 layers in each, you know, column if you want. And within those 6 layers, they can arborize and hit about 100 guys, you know, within a diameter of 10 or so. And that's how we are able to connect one neuron to 6,000 others. But you realize that we are not copying this spike into 6,000 spikes. So our bandwidth that we use is much less than if you wanted to implement completely random connectivity. Or another way of saying it is that we can actually increase by a factor of maybe about 100 the connectivity we implement in this way. And so this is just showing you how, you know, what the programmable space constant looks like for different program parameters. And but that slide actually simplifies things. It's actually not a 1D mesh. It's actually a tree, okay? So the way that the chips talk to each other is each chip can talk to its two daughters, and those two guys can talk to those four, and those four can talk to those eight. That gets you up to 15. So we have the appendix here, which is chip number 16, okay, to get us over a million neurons, okay? So that's how the whole system is organized, okay? So just in the last few minutes, what am I doing now? But yeah, in the last 5 minutes, I'll talk a little bit about some modeling that we started doing and with this. And, you know, I think that this is something where it's basically early stages for us, and we'd love to be collaborating with more people on these kinds of models. And so right now we have a collaboration with Turin Moore, who is my next door neighbor at Stanford. Turin studies attention, and, you know, basically he's been doing a lot of recording from FEF and V4. And as you can see here, there's actually FEF and V4 are reciprocally connected. There's connections going from the superficial layers to FEF, and there's connections coming in from FEF to the superficial and deep layers in V4. Okay, this represents V4 here. And so we are in sort of very early days. Eventually, what we want to be able to do is to build these kind of detailed microsecond models where we model different cell types in the different layers and their interaction, and as well as the interaction with the feedforward and feedback projections. On the experimental side, what Turin is working on, there's a student that I'm co-advising with Turin who is doing these experiments, is using these lamina probes or these U probes to record simultaneously from all the layers in V4, in an awake behaving monkey with and without attention, right? And then we want to basically then use this to develop the model and go back and test predictions from the model with this approach as well. And so, you know, right now we have a pretty simple model of FEF. We just have two layers, an inhibitory cell population and an excitatory cell population. And then we have similarly an excitatory and inhibitory cell population in V4. So these are similar to models like Adid and Wang, and these guys have developed. You know, we're using that as a starting point. But this is just to give you a feel for what you do. So you write basically in Python your description of your model. So, you know, we can say this SOMA is a quadratic integrated fire model. It's got some refractory period. It's got some membrane time constant. This list goes on. And then that's the SOMA. And then we build the neuron because the neuron can have a dendrite. It can have a SOMA and so forth. This one is just a single compartment. And then you basically specify, you know, how big, you know, up to 256 by 256, you know, how many of those neurons that you want. And you define all of them and you hook them together. You describe the connectivity. So you can see I have a vertical connection here, which means that corresponding locations are connected. And so I think I went the wrong way. And so, So, you know, you take that model and you have your Python code. And at the end of your Python code, there's a map network command. What that does is basically it compiles your code onto NeuroGrid, okay? So in this particular case, map network basically mapped this layer onto this chip, that layer onto that chip, and so forth. And then it put in all the connections between them. It programmed those memories and so forth to make the connections happen. And then it starts running your network. And in the GUI, you're going to see this come up. This is basically your animation of all what's happening in all those chips. These are all the parameters for each of those chips. You can change them interactively in real time. Once the thing is running, you can see merely what happens with that. I'll show you here an example of that. So this is a network that's running. I'm going to have to run through this again, but you know, you basically manipulate it like it's a 3D object. This is a connectivity mode which you can probe on a cell and you can see where it connects to. And then this is going back into the activity mode where you can see, you know, the activity. The inhibitory cells have a lot of activity. You can also see the heterogeneity among the neurons. We've got a calibration process whereby, you know, when you specify these neuronal parameters, we basically can calibrate the chip so we can ensure that we apply the right biases to give the time constant that you requested or the threshold and so forth. Now, that just defines the mean of the population, right? There's going to be some variability around that. Okay, but it's actually less than what you see in the brain. So if your model doesn't work here, I don't think it's going to work in the real thing. But anyway, so that's basically the mechanics of how things work. Just to show you the results of the model, so this is sort of the attention model where you've got your FEF layers here and your V4 layers here. Visual inputs are stimulating these two batches here. That's the average firing rate that you see. When you cue FEF to attend to this location, you present those same visual stimuli, you get a stronger response at the blue attended location than you get at the unattended location. This shows the kind of top-down modulation that you expect to see with attention. And so I'm out of time. I'm just going to summarize now, and then we can go for some questions. So basically, you know, there's the three main points. So we use an analog to emulate, you know, any kind of ion channels, and which allow us then to basically be able to use the same tips to model different types of neurons. We have these soft wires where we can actually reprogram the connections among those neuron populations. And we have this network among the chips, a tree network, which allows us to connect dozens of chips together efficiently, which gets us to the, you know, a system that can simulate a million neurons with a billion synapses in real time using a few watts. So thank you very much for your attention.
Yeah, thank you very much for this great talk. Do we have questions?
I wonder, so your system probably works in real time, right? So the neurons run at real time. Can you link it to some to robotics, to some actuators or some?
Yeah,
something
okay.
Like that?
Yeah. So the question was that, you know, can we interface with robots? And it's like the number one thing that undergrads want to do in the lab, right? So of course we're doing it. Yeah, so yeah, we are actually doing that. We're doing some. Actually, the more interesting thing we are pursuing there is we've got a collaboration with Christian Shenoy's lab, and we are basically looking at using these neuromorphic chips as decoders for motor cortex activity to control like a prosthesis or a robot arm. And that's one of the things we can do with this system. And so, yeah, so we are looking at that as well. But that's more on the engineering side of the part of the lab, yeah. There's one back there.
So I had actually two questions. The first one, how do you deal with temporal asynchrony? I mean, the temporal discretization of this routing scheme.
Yeah, okay.
And the second question was, can you have like plastic routing within the network within the running time?
I mean, So the first question, how do we deal with asynchrony? We actually have measurements. So basically, I can basically deliver, you know, over a billion spikes per second, you know, across the network with a latency or jitter in the spike timing of less than a microsecond. Okay, so if I have, you know, 8 chips firing 2 million spikes per second, and I take those spikes and I fan them out to all 16 chips across the network, I get a jitter of less than a microsecond. It's just the electronics is fast, right? So it's not a problem. Now, the second question as to can we do on the fly plasticity, you know, basically rerouting, no, we can't. I mean, we've actually designed chips previously that can do that. But in NeuroGrid, we limited that. It's basically expensive. And since it was designed more as a simulation platform for people to test out their own ideas about what kind of networks can give rise to certain kinds of behavior they're studying. There's no, basically you have to reprogram it. There's no, it's not autonomously. There's no learning or plasticity in the system. Do we want to take over here?
So you have Hodgkin-Huxley on a chip, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you can even get the time constants to have the right voltage dependence.
Yeah.
Just like in Hodgkin-Huxley.
Yeah.
Have the bell-shaped characteristic. But is that important?
Yeah.
I mean, it's great, but is it? Can't you just do a model with a voltage independent time constant, get that to spike, and connect those spiking units?
Yeah.
What do you get from voltage dependent?
Yeah,
that's constants?
A question for you guys, right? I mean, I am providing the simulation platform, and people tell me that this is how the neurons behave, so I want to provide that thing. So the point is that if we don't include it, we are not going to figure out what it's good for, right? And I don't want to prejudice the answer, okay? So if you ask me the question, from my engineering point of view, it's actually easier to make the time constant nonlinear than to make it linear, okay? Because the transistors are exponential, and you get this kind of behavior for free, okay? So it's actually cheaper, it's harder to make it linear, so, yeah. It's a win-win situation. Okay.
Yeah, then thank you again.
Yeah, thanks.